Hey guys, this week's episode is brought to you by the Annie Selke Companies, including Dash and Albert Rugs and Pinecone Hill Bedding. And Annie is like constantly schooling us on all things beds and bedding, so stay tuned for my latest aha moment with her. And be sure to use the code YHL15 to save 15% off at annieselke.com/YHL.
I'm John.
And I'm Sherry.
We like home stuff.
We like talking.
And we like the occasional game show sound effect. So welcome to Young House Love Has a Podcast, where we have deep and not so deep conversations about DIY, design, and life at home.
Today we're sharing how I accidentally saved our beach house from frozen pipes, but we still ended up with water gushing out of some walls. Also, are those expensive trendy paints really worth the extra cost? The answer might surprise you.
You know, when you think about buying a beach house, your mind does not go to issues like frozen pipes. You think sand.
Sun. Children's laughter.
Maybe heat is an issue, but frozen pipes was not something we ever expected to deal with, but it was like a saga we went through for a couple weeks recently.
Behind the scenes, we were sweating it up. Like waking up in the morning every day during the bomb cyclone where it was 0 degrees out and saying, there's no way they're not frozen.
Yep. We wanted to get to the conclusion of the saga before we shared it with you guys. So here is the full story.
Right. John was like, we're not talking about this till we get through it.
No, I didn't want to jinx anything. It has a mostly happy ending.
It does involve some things being frozen, but not where you think.
Yep. So let's rewind to about New Year's. We were at the beach house in Cape Charles celebrating New Year's there. And Sherry and I were discovering, because it was some of the coldest days of the year, like in the teens, which we had not experienced there before.
Right. Many mornings were like 10 degrees, yeah. 7 degrees.
And we noticed that the floors on the first floor were very cold, like the hardwood floors.
Like alarmingly gusty is the way yes. I would describe it. Like you could stand on certain cracks in the really old, gorgeous pine floors. And I was saying to John, it feels like someone with a hairdryer on cold is blowing it like everywhere, because there were these cracks, not just along like where one room meets another room, not like transition cracks, but just like throughout the entire floor, there were like gusts coming through.
Well, what Sherry's describing is that it is an old house with the original floors. And so there are just some gaps between some of the floorboards because they naturally expand and contract with the temperature. And this was something that we sort of were warned about, that these old homes in Cape Charles have some of these issues, especially because with these old original floors, the hardwood planks are right on top of the joists. It's not like in our home here or most modern homes where the hardwood is put on subfloor. So you have like an extra layer between the crawl space and the floors that you step on. Ours are just right on top of those joists. So they're the only barrier between us and the air beneath.
Well, but we insulated the entire crawl space.
Yeah, except for insulation. Yes.
Right. So I was saying, I don't understand how there can be these gusts. I think the insulation has fallen down in a few areas. And we're like really good friends with our contractor, Sean, at this point. We called him. We're like, Sean, something is weird. Like there are gusts coming through the floor. Do you mind just checking it out? Because we paid for the insulation through him and I wanted him to know if his subcontractor did a bad job or needed to fix something. Like we wanted him to see it. So he goes under there.
Wait, you need to establish though. He made it out there the night before the bomb cyclone hit.
Right. That's when all the snow covered Cape Charles, the bridges and tunnels were shut down. And then it was just freezing, 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 like 0 degrees for a full week. So that's when everyone was like, the pipes are going
to
freeze.
Right. So we get a text from him when he goes under to check the insulation that he noticed that the plumber had not finished insulating our pipes.
Cue all the freaking out.
Right. Because the absolute last scenario in which you want to have uninsulated pipes is when your town is about to be hit with sub-freezing temperatures for over a week.
Right. I was like speechless. He's not going to come out right now and do it. And then the snow is going to incapacitate everyone for like a few days. So we're just, it's like a close your eyes and cross your fingers type moment.
We basically resigned ourselves to the fact that our pipes are probably going to freeze, but at least like it was clear that there was an error on the plumbing insulation, so it would be up to them and hopefully it would not cause any damage inside the house.
Exactly, because every time we leave, we turn the water off.
We have like a checklist when we leave the house. Like I turn off the water heater, I make sure all the lights are off, the doors are locked, and I go outside and I turn off the main water shutoff outside the house.
Right, so even though that was shut off, there was still all the active water that had been in the pipes up to that point. And so our fear was, after learning about the bomb cycle and the snow, which we hadn't known when we left, we realized there's all this waiting water. You know, there's water going up to the sink. There's water under the house and all those uninsulated pipes. The pipes are full of water. There's just no more water coming. So we didn't worry about like a big gushing leak that, you know, like spouted for hours and filled the house with water. But it was a very real possibility that any of those pipes that still had water in it from when we shut it off could crack or break in a way that the next time we got to the house, we wouldn't have any water pressure. There might be some breaks under the foundation or even places like under the dishwasher at the sink. We were certainly worried because it was such an abnormally cold, long duration. Like, it wasn't just one cold day.
No one was used to it out there. And to be clear, the issue we were worried about is that when water freezes, it expands. And so if you've got a pipe filled with water that freezes, it can expand and break and cause cracks in your pipes. So we didn't want any of that. That's what we were worried about.
Right.
So a few days after the bomb cyclone hit, the plumber was finally able to make it out there. He was backed up with other people having these same concerns. And miracle of all miracles, we were fine.
And he said, "You must have taken the pressure off somehow because the water wasn't tight in the pipes." And I was like, "What do you mean taking the pressure off?" And he's like, "You know, like run the hose outside." And I said, "No, I didn't do that.
Like turn on a faucet. We hadn't done that."
And then I was like, "Wait, right before we left, I ran in and I went to the bathroom." And then I asked the kids, like, "You sure you don't have to go to the bathroom?" And nobody had to go but me, but I flushed the toilets one time. And he said, "You're the luckiest person in the world, because I think running in that last moment and flushing the toilet was enough to take the pressure off so there wasn't a bunch of water like filling the pipes and it did not expand and crack. So you're welcome for my tiny bladder."
For once, that has saved our butts.
It usually results in a lot of stops on the way to and from Cape Charles because I'm the only one in the car who has to go to the bathroom, but I saved the day this time.
He did give us some tips though also, because he said that taking the pressure off is a secondary step we need to do every time we leave and shut off the water. Like, shutting off the main valve outside is a good step, but what he recommends is actually opening up an outdoor spigot, because usually those are the lowest points on your plumbing. And so that will release a good amount of water from all the pipes in your house if you ever have concerns about freezing. So that is now part of our new routine. And I should add, he said we were very lucky too, because there were so many people out there in the Cape Charles area and on the Eastern Shore who had issues with frozen pipes, even people who live there full time, that they're backed up through like April getting everyone repaired.
Yeah. We are so lucky. I'm so grateful for that toilet flush. And the other funny thing, because you're probably like, "Oh, yay, but what about your really cold floor?" While the plumber was under there, he noticed there was like a big gap between our foundation and some of the piers. And it wasn't structural. Like, it wasn't like the house is going to fall down. But those gaps need to be filled with spray foam or some other kind of insulation, because we did have basically a cross breeze blowing through the crawl space. And he said, that is enough to freeze pipes. It's enough to make your floors feel like they're doing that gusting thing, because you actually have a breeze.
So Sherry also feels validated. She was right all along that there was some incomplete insulation work done as well. So we're getting that fixed as well. But you know, we did say there was an issue with something freezing. And this is where Sherry and I put on our dunce caps.
We were so, so stupid, you guys, on a high of we didn't freeze the pink house. We were like, "Well, you know what he said? We should check the duplex." And he taught me a way to check if you have a leak. So this is the other thing he taught me, right? He taught me, take the pressure off by opening the hose bib. And the other thing he said is, and listen, when you turn on your water after you've had it off, just stare at your meter for a while and see if your meter jumps or spins, because that means you have water moving somewhere, like out of a drip, right, out of a pipe, something. You know, he said a slight drip, you might not see the meter move very much, but leave it alone for 5 minutes and come back and take note of where the needle is. It might inch up slightly, and that means you have a very small drip.
Yeah, and I think we were just feeling emboldened by having survived at the pink house that we went, and I sort of kicked away some snow to find the meter for the duplex, and I just gently turned on the water, and boy did that thing spin.
And he was like, Sherry, I turned on the meter and it's spinning. Let's go in the duplex and figure out what it is. And I was like, oh gosh, why did we do that? We have no heat in this house.
No.
The electrical has been turned off and the water's been turned off. So it was fine. It was dry. But
right,
for some reason, we had this new tip of look at the meter.
I think we just wanted to like have all the boxes checked. Like, none of our pipes froze. Well, had we bothered to go in the house before I turned on the meter, we would have noticed the toilet on the first floor is a block of ice.
The toilet fully froze. Have you guys ever seen that? I had never in my life. It was the water that you'd sit above in the toilet, like not in the tank, we're talking about in the bowl, was one solid chunk of ice.
Yes. So yeah, we turned on the water. I saw the thing spin. We ran inside and there was just water gushing out of the wall above the kitchen.
Pouring out of the walls. Just like splashing on windowsills from above through the wall.
Yeah.
So we quickly turned the water off. We stared at each other for 10 minutes like, why did we do that?
Yeah,
that was What's wrong with us?
That was so dumb. Of course it was frozen.
Of course. There's no heat in this house. And the funny thing is it doesn't matter because all the plumbing is being replaced. So it was just like us testing the meter trick, I think.
It was us just like having a lot of false confidence that like we were invincible, but clearly we were not.
We were not. Our toilets were frozen.
Right. So we clean up the water. It's fine. I mean, all of that stuff is being demoed out anyways, but it was just like...
Why did we do
that? Stupid, stupid facepalm. But in slightly happier news, I wanted to give you guys a little update on my word of the year. You may remember in episode 78, we were talking about resolutions, and I said how I like to pick like a word to focus on throughout the year instead of making a whole long list of resolutions like Sherry likes to do.
Like a three-page document, double-spaced.
Yes. But I was having trouble coming up with my word, and you guys gave me a lot of good suggestions, and I did land on one. The most popular suggestion, because I talked about wanting to guilt myself less about things that I feel like I'm not doing up to my standard, like if I am not getting as much done, or we're not keeping the houses clean, or we're not, you know, eating at home enough. I wanted to just like kind of release some of that so I wasn't beating myself up over little things. And the most popular thing people recommended was the word grace. Like I should give myself a little bit more grace in these things, which I thought was a great summation of that idea. So thank you everyone who suggested that word. I'm not going with it.
He's such a rebel, you guys.
Well, and it's for a good reason. It's because there was sort of another half of what I wanted to resolve for the year that I didn't talk about on the podcast. And I wanted to find a word that kind of encompassed both of those things.
You guys were supposed to read his mind fully.
Yeah, I didn't give you all the information, so you're not at fault. But my word, if you're ready for it, I warn Sherry it's going to be very anticlimactic.
I'm just bracing myself for a word like the.
No. My word is okay.
I mean, I like okay. It's yes. Fine. It's okay.
You're trying to be nice.
It's okay.
Let me explain it. First of all, I thought that it was a nice fit for this kind of grace and sort of guilt-free or less guilt thing because it's a good word for me to hold on to just say, like, it's okay. It's okay that we go out to eat more than we meant to that week. It's okay that I didn't get to everything on my list.
I just like it because it's having a moment because have you seen those t-shirts that are like, world's okayest dad?
Oh, no.
Yeah, okay is like having a moment right now.
See, it's a trendy word, guys. But so here's the other half of it, the other reason why it's going to be a helpful word for me, as anticlimactic as it is. Is the other thing that I want to sort of check myself on this year is, I guess, what may be described as some FOMO, especially like social media FOMO. And for those of you who aren't familiar, FOMO is the fear of missing out. It's that feeling where like you see people on social media doing something else and you feel envious or left out or like you play the world's tiniest violin for yourself.
Which is something I'm like, I would rather be at home than 99% of places. But John is always like, oh, maybe we should have gone to that conference because some of our friends are there. Or like, oh, I wish we had gone to that event even though we both weren't feeling well, so we missed it. Like if there's a reason I'm not going, I'm fine with it.
Right. It's okay, right?
It's okay.
See, it's a helpful word. Yeah, I am totally guilty of this. And I think social media is a big culprit for me, both in sort of my personal friends on Facebook and stuff, seeing them doing things, going on outings, you know, doing fun things with their family that you just have this sense of like, oh man, that's really cool. I wish I could be doing that right now as well. Even if the thing you're doing is perfectly fine too. And that's what I'm trying to remind myself is like, it's okay that I'm not there because what I have here is good as well. And I should be satisfied with what I'm doing. I should be happy about that and not feel like I'm missing out on something.
That experience would be okay, but this one's okay as well.
Exactly. I think also on sort of like the business side of it, and this happens to me on Instagram more because I use Instagram more to follow like other bloggers, other people in the interior design space, you know, other DIYers. And I think also I see a lot of people there doing cool things, like they're doing cool home projects or they're going to cool conferences like Sherry talked about, or just having some cool business milestone. And I'm like, wow, I'm happy for them. But at the same time, should I be working towards that? Am I not working hard enough? Like, is my hustle not as good? I am very proud of all that Sherry and I do and what we've been able to accomplish over the years. And like, our plates are very full. Our hearts are very full. That sounds very cheesy, but you know what I mean. And a lot of times there are things that make no sense at all. Like, I'll give an example. Our friends, Chris and Julia, right? Mm-hmm. They recently bought a fixer-upper cabin out in the mountains.
Are you jealous of the cabin when we have two fixer-uppers?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's not rational. But I saw it. I was like, that is so cool. Like, look at their view. Like, I'm excited they have this project. Like, a cabin sounds so cozy. Like, I have all these feelings where I am so excited excited for them, but at the same time want to like project myself into it. And I have to check myself and say like, hey, dummy.
We cannot do a cabin right now, dummy.
Like logistically, it makes no sense. And you've got all this other stuff going on for yourself that is exactly the same. Like I've got a beach house that I'm working on. Like I have so much to be grateful for. Why am I having FOMO about this other thing?
That is very strange indeed. Because sometimes I'm like, I'm a little overwhelmed with pink house and duplex. Like well, it's a lot.
That's the other thing. Like I also see all these people who are doing these incredible things with their business, like launching all these products and having this team that works on these big makeovers and like running full design firms. And that rationally is not anything that I want to do. Like we don't want to have a design firm. That's right. Not a goal of our business.
You know how many people we want to manage? Zero.
Yeah. I have enough trouble managing Sherry, guys. So I decided that I needed some more conscious reminders to myself to like not let those FOMO thoughts get the best of me and make me feel bad about what I do have. Because when I have that pause, I realize how grateful and how happy I am for what things are and that I don't need to feel like I'm missing out on what other people are doing. Like people can do their own thing and I can enjoy watching what they do and it doesn't have to be my life. Like I don't have to do everything that everyone else is doing.
Sounds like your word should be gratitude. Just saying.
Oh, well. That does have a bit more flair than okay. It has prongs. You love prongs, right?
I love a good prong.
It has my like guilt-free prong and my like no FOMO prong. Like things are okay.
Are you spelling it like O dot K dot? Because that's probably more like two words. But if you're spelling it O-K-A-Y, then I think it meets the requirement.
What if I just use like the emoji symbol with like that A-OK fingers?
You're like Prince.
Basically. It's what resolutions are in 2018, Sherry. They're just emojis.
Oh my gosh. Maybe a hashtag OK?
Well, and that actually reminds me, speaking of 2018, we just finished putting together our annual family yearbook, which a lot of you guys have been asking us about lately because this is the first year that we cannot use our old go-to My Publisher. My Publisher was the photo book company that we'd use for years to create these annual family photo books. You like, we've got a nice stack of them up in our office, but they shuttered.
Shuttered?
They literally shuttered. They were absorbed into Shutterfly. And so we have been sort of holding our breath until it was time to create our next photo book to figure out what company we were going to use in their place. And a lot of you guys have been asking us lately, since it's the new year and we make these books every January, what we decided on.
I will estimate the amount of people who have asked me, who did you use now that my publisher is gone? My estimation is a million. I get the question every minute. So this is an update you'll hear here, and we're probably going to do an update on the blog and on Instagram and on Facebook because the question is just like, we're being pelted with it.
I don't know how we became the ambassadors for like what photo book to use every year.
And how did we figure out who we were going to use?
Oh, we got tons of recommendations from people.
Right. On Facebook and Instagram, we just said like, hey, they're gone. Who should we use? Who have you guys used that you loved? And like hundreds and hundreds of comments later, the most commonly recommended two were Mixbooks and Blurb.
Yes.
Shutterfly got a bunch, but it also got a bunch of negative. It was like polarizing. We just thought about who got the most, even among Mixbooks and Blurb, and it was Blurb. So yep. We tried Blurb.
Yep. And I will say we have ordered the book. It has not arrived yet, so I can't speak yet to the final like quality of it. But the experience of putting it together was fine. In some ways, it was actually more efficient than the My Publisher one was. You can download a software to your desktop called Bookwrite, I think, and it allows you to build your book offline on your computer, and when you're done, upload it, just like you could do with My Publisher. So it actually went pretty quickly, and I was able to order a book that's just a hair smaller than my Publisher book, so I think it will stack nicely on the old My Publisher books. And actually, the price ended up being like within $2 of what I used to spend on My Publisher.
Yeah, so very comparable. The layout process, very similar. We can't talk about the quality, but when it comes, we'll give you guys all an update. So that's who we used, Blurb.
Blurb. But now we're bringing back our favorite music for the new year.
We need this music in every episode.
Yep. It's for a segment we call, Can We Just Talk About? So guys, can we talk about paint? And specifically, is expensive paint better than cheap paint? Because I came across an article recently from the Washington Post entitled, Are Expensive Trendy Paint Brands Really Worth It? And you probably are answering that question in your head right now based on your own experience. I will say I did the same thing and was surprised by the answer in the article.
And I don't know the answer because John wanted to surprise me.
I thought it would be a more lively discussion if you didn't know.
This is like a quiz, but not veiled as a quiz. It just has different music.
Right, exactly. Before I actually tell you what the conclusion of the article was, I thought Sherry and I should talk a little bit about why people typically recommend you spend more money on paint and you not just get like the cheapest thing out there. Because Over our 11, 12 years of painting, we have certainly used a variety of paint brands at various levels of cost.
Right.
I would say when we first bought our house back in 2006, we went right for like the most budget option. I think we painted the entire house in Glidden paint.
Yep, $20 a can. And we even for our trim, people would say, well, what white did you use? We bought off-the-shelf white. We just walked up the paint aisle, picked the white base paint, and never even had any drops added. Like, we just bought white semi-gloss base paint, and that's how we did all the trim.
And I think since it was really our only experience with paint, like, we were plenty happy with it. Like, we liked the colors that we picked. It went on just fine. So I think if you asked me back then, I would have said, just buy the cheapest paint, because we had a fine experience with affordable paint.
I think it's like anything else, right? You don't know what you're missing until you try it. At least That was my experience. So what happened is, I think if we had never become bloggers, we would still be doing that. But as you're sharing your painting adventures, people are saying, hey, have you ever tried this brand of paint?
Right.
I really like it. And what happened is, over the years, enough people put the bug in our ear, you should try Benjamin Moore. Benjamin Moore is awesome. Yes, it's more expensive, but you use less paint because it's fewer coats, or it's less work because it goes on thicker and you don't have these like parts that bleed through.
Right. And I think at some point you got your hands on a Benjamin Moore deck, which certainly had more color options than we had ever gotten from pulling the swatches at the display in Home Depot for Glidden.
Exactly.
So I think that quickly converted us to a brand like Benjamin Moore just because of the color options. And for a long time, we also color matched those to more affordable paint. Like, we would go into Home Depot and say, hey, we'd like this Benjamin Moore color, and they would do their best to match it.
Right. Did you guys know this? This is like a sub, can we just talk about? When you color match at Lowe's or Home Depot and you use a different brand than they sell, we've had it so inaccurate that we did it as an experiment, and it was like a complete shade difference, and it was a different undertone. Like, the cool Benjamin Moore color that we color matched looks kind of tawny, lighter, and brownish. So that's how different it is. And the problem is because they're using a different base. So when Benjamin Moore is using their white base and they add their color droplets, it's different than when you go into Lowe's and they use their white base and its own color droplets.
Yeah, and those color droplets also are a factor. Like, the pigments might be formulated differently. They might go in a different way. So it's not going to be precise. I think we've had some color matching that was pretty spot on and some that was not so accurate. This actually article from Washington Post said that they did a test of that, and they found the colors were mixed within 1%.
I mean, that's really close. That has not been my experience at all. So that's really interesting. Maybe they've gotten better, because I probably did this experiment 3 years ago.
Yeah. I think we had enough inconsistency with the results that we started to say, like, if we find a color that we like, let's use that brand paint so that we're sure we're getting the color right. Because, you know, we have mulled over the differences between two slightly off gray swatches.
Exactly. In our kitchen, we wanted the perfect color to match our white cabinets and our white trim, which were different but similar. So we needed the wall color to be slightly gray, but not too cold and not too warm. And so when we found the swatch, we were like, whatever paint this is, that's what we're getting. And it ended up being Behr, and we got a gallon of Behr.
Yeah, we couldn't risk it being slightly off. And so going back, we used Benjamin Moore for years because, again, we had been using their colors mostly. At one point, we even curated some color collections for them on their website. So we were pretty consistently using Benjamin Moore for a while there. And we did experience that when you're using a slightly more expensive paint, like, I think those gallons were usually around like the $50 mark.
Yeah, we try to find coupons or like go in there when they were having some sort of discount.
Yeah, but we did find that using a slightly more expensive paint did have some benefits. Like, it went on more smoothly, like the application process was easier and you had less drips. And, you know, long term, the higher quality paint is supposed to last longer, you know, fade less, might be more washable or scrubbable. You know, depending on the exact type of paint that you buy, it might have different qualities. Like, some, you know, offer a primer in it so that you can get it in one coat, even though I always still recommend two coats.
Yeah. One thing I would say that I noticed as a huge difference, just as the person who cuts in, you know, I'm the one with the brush doing all the corners and, you know, the edging, I'm going along the molding. I noticed that more expensive paint is just thicker. And the way I would describe cheaper paint is it can be splashy. And so when you're doing those really careful edges, it's almost like you want the paint gelled. That's a bad description, but you don't want it splashy because it's really hard to stick within that line. So when the paint holds together nicely and is a thicker consistency, I can cut in really cleanly with Benjamin Moore or Sherwin-Williams. And I think it's because they have that thickness. Although I have been hearing that lately, the paint at Home Depot and Lowe's has been thickened and it's been getting better in quality. And I imagine that maybe they're closing the gap. And so if I tried, you know, Olympic or Valspar now, maybe it wouldn't be as bad.
Right. And we more recently have been using a lot of Sherwin-Williams paints in our house. This was primarily because when we did that show house back in 2014 and a spec house after that, and also working on our beach house, we have found that most contractors love Sherwin-Williams. Like, even when we had our house painted here, the exterior of this house trim we had painted, they required us to give them Sherwin-Williams colors because that was like the thing they swore by.
Yeah, they only use that. A lot of exterior paint places will only use Sherwin-Williams because it holds up and the warranty is better. And even our interior painters at the beach house, they were like, I don't do Behr and Valspar. And so it's really interesting to hear painters, because it wasn't even like they were saying Benjamin Moore. They very consistently were saying Sherwin-Williams.
Yeah, I think that's what kind of started pushing us towards Sherwin-Williams and being more familiar with their color. And so we're more likely to look at them and choose them for any painting project we have.
I think it's the same as the Benjamin Moore deck. We started to get Sherwin-Williams decks. So when we're picking a dark color for the tub or for the railing or anything we're doing, those pocket doors at the pink house, we have these decks. And so it's exactly like Benjamin Moore. We're just going with Sherwin-Williams because we like the colors.
Yeah. Okay, but are you ready for the conclusion of the article?
I mean, I keep seeing at Home Depot how they say Behr has like the top rated blah, blah, blah.
Well, so for this article from the Washington Post, you know, are expensive, trendy paint brands really worth it? They were relying on a lot of information from Consumer Reports.
Okay.
Because Consumer Reports test paint.
Do they just roll with it, though, or do they cut in? Because I feel like the way you feel the difference is when you're cutting in with it.
I do not know, because I do not subscribe to Consumer Reports, so I can't read the whole thing.
We're not ready to spend that $5 or whatever it is.
I can only read the summary from the Washington Post. But I did see that they tested 21 interior paints, including expensive brands like Farrow and Ball and Pratt and Lambert, as well as hardware store brands, as they put it. And guess what was their top paint?
It's going to be Behr. It's always Behr.
It was Behr Marquee.
Oh my goodness.
Yep. Four of their top five interior paints were from hardware stores. Three of them were Behr paints and one was a Valspar.
That's so crazy. What about Sherwin-Williams?
Sherwin-Williams was not in the top five. The fifth one is Benjamin Moore Aura Paint.
Why do you think painters love Sherwin-Williams so much? Maybe they have a better warranty. Maybe it's just like if it peels in 10 years, they'll give you a rebate or something.
Maybe. I don't know. They did also test exterior paints. They tested 23 exterior paints. Behr got the top spot again.
Wow.
But Sherwin-Williams was on that list at the number three spot with the Emerald that we use on our exterior.
Yeah, Emerald is really good exterior paint.
But the funny thing is none of the premium paints made it in here. Like the Farrow and Balls, the Pratt and Lamberts, like none of them were on these top five lists.
Again, I'm intimidated by them.
I know. We've never bought them because, I mean, we've spent $70 on like a Sherwin-Williams paint can, but like I'm not ready to go to $100.
I think part of it is I don't have the deck. We all know that's like once I get the deck, I'm in.
The funny thing about this, and I feel like kind of the subtext to the conclusion of this article at least, is that there's not that much noticeable difference between the paints. Because they said Behr's premium plus enamel scored almost as high as their Marquee. So like within the brand, two of them were very close. But the Marquee is $12 more.
Huh.
So they're saying like they're basically the same. One of them is $12 more. Why don't you just get the cheaper premium plus enamel?
Maybe it's like the Emperor's New Clothes and we're all being duped and it's all the same exact paint in every can. And we're like, ooh, Pratt and Lambert, this feels so great.
Well, I think there probably is a certain amount of that. Like it feels fancy and upscale to choose from those. And I'm sure their formulas and their bases and everything are different. Like there's something that goes into it. But what Consumer Reports...
Gold, diamonds.
Right, exactly. Whatever Consumer Reports found in their testing basically says that they're a wash. Like the stuff that you can get at your hardware store will perform just as well.
I've heard like color tone, like depth of color, and the amount of pigment that you can add goes up as you spend more. So like a Benjamin Moore high-end paint or even a Pratt and Lambert might have more pigment and resulting in a richer color. But if you're just talking about performance and how it rolls on the wall, maybe you don't account for a higher pigment or a better, richer tone.
Right. And again, this is where my not having Consumer Reports subscription holds me back from answering that question, because I do know they judge things on certain parameters like coverage or whether you needed a primer. And things were rated slightly differently when you looked at some of the different performance measures. But again, they said overall, primarily these ones from Behr, Valspar, and Benjamin Moore were your best choices for interior.
Huh.
Which is also odd because you know the one paint that I've complained about recently?
Splashy old Behr.
Yeah, we used a Behr Premium Plus Ultra paint to do our kitchen walls. It was Irish Mist by Behr, FYI. So we got the Behr paint and I found it to be very thin and splashy and hard to work with.
John was not okay with it, you guys.
I said to myself then, like, this is what happens when you get used to premium paints and you go back to the store paints.
And then you read Consumer Reports and it was all in your head.
Clearly I'm wrong. So I feel like I want to give Behr Marquee a try again. They say it's $39 per gallon. Or maybe I should use that Behr Premium Plus enamel because that's $12 cheaper.
Pretty close.
Yeah. So anyways, I will put a link to this article in the show notes at younghouselove.com/podcast so you can read the whole thing. And if you've got a Consumer Reports subscription, feel free to dive deeper and let us know what you learned.
Because we're too cheap for that.
Right. Our research department has no budget this year, guys.
And also, if anyone's wondering how I'm doing on that blank space resolution, trying to clear up surfaces, make everything lighter, I have a big update and a realization of how to accomplish that more easily. But first, we have to take a quick break. We first learned about the Annie Selke companies who's sponsoring this week's episode when we purchased one of their Dash and Albert runners for our stairs many, many years ago. But lately we seem to be finding ourselves talking about sheets and bedding all the time.
Yeah, Annie Selke is also behind Pinecone Hill Bedding. And since we're always impressed by how warm and cozy their beds look in their catalogs, I asked Annie this question when we last talked. What do you do in your own home to sort of transition your bed to the colder months?
I add layers. So, you know, sheet, blanket, quilt. And then I'll have a throw somewhere there in case I don't want to get under all the covers.
Oh, so that's what a throw's for?
That's what I use it for. So if I'm watching TV or reading or something and you just don't want your feet to get cold.
Oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. I thought throws were purely decorative.
No, they're totally functional. It's like your blankie when you're a kid. You just carry it to make you more comfortable.
So if you guys are looking for a new blankie or other bedding to keep you warm this season, head over to annieselke.com/YHL to check them out.
I'm especially drooling over these chunky cable knit throws. I want to hibernate under like 15 to 16 of them. Like I want to be super, super warm.
Well, and you can also get 15% off your order with code YHL15. Again, that's YHL15 at annieselke.com/YHL.
So if you guys at home are listening and you're trying to decorate a bookcase or a mantle, this is going to solve all your problems.
That's a big promise, solving all your problems, Sherry.
Well, it might solve one of them. It might help you wrap your head around what to do with those spaces because I am pretty well-versed at what to put on a mantle, what to put on a tabletop, what to put on a bookshelf, and yet I realized that I was making this stupid mistake over and over again around the house, and it was why I wanted more simplicity and more blank space.
You are digging something in here, aren't you?
I am digging something. The problem I had was I was using too many little objects, and they were getting cluttery. What I'm digging is bigger, more substantial objects. So if you have a mantle or a bookshelf and you're like, it's so busy, I know what I'll do. I'll take 5 things away and then I'll be like, blank space. And then you step back and you're like, oh, it just looks unfinished. It looks empty. It looks like it needs more volume. The answer is not to add the little things back in. It's to take all the little things out and then try putting one large object there. The example I can give you is we have a big console table in the dining room. And for months, I've been messing around with things, putting a candle here, a stack of books there, a little vase here. But we have big art and a big console table. So what I realized was, oh, I need something more proportional. I need something bigger. And so instead, on one end, I put this big, beautiful, fake potted fern. So it's like this faux fern I got from Target. It comes in a big, gorgeous white ceramic planter base. I think it's like $29. I'll put the link in the show notes for you because I'm actually obsessed with it. I'm going to buy more for the beach house and the duplex because I think they're great because you don't have to water them.
So that's what you're digging. It's a fern.
I'm digging large-scale objects because I want to find a few more and put them in the show notes for people because I think when you see them in a mood board, you'll understand what I mean. It's not a little bud vase. It's more of like a big ceramic vase. And it's not clear. It's probably opaque. So picture like instead of all your papers being stored in a wire bin, which is what I've had in the office for a long time, very recently I replaced that for a fabric bin so it's covered and you don't see the papers. It's amazing, you guys. It's so much less busy. So basically think in terms of big objects that are opaque. And I don't mean throw away all your little objects that are meaningful and get a bunch of dumb things at Target right away in like a panic. I don't mean that. I mean slowly acquire things you love. I think what I'm trying to say is that sometimes less is more, but less doesn't mean tiny scale.
Right. And I think the problem can be, like we've been guilty of this, I'm sure some other people have, is like the smaller things are more affordable. Like if you have the choice between two vases, like, oh, I can get the smaller one because it's cheaper. But what you're saying is you might have to fight that instinct and splurge a little bit more on the larger object, because that will, in the end, do more for you.
Like, I could roll through Target and buy a little thing here and a little thing there and a little thing there, and that would never solve my problem, because my problem was I needed a big thing to anchor this side of the console table or to anchor my mantle.
So that's your new mantra: fewer, larger things.
Exactly. I mean, don't go crazy, but you'd be surprised how one big thing can solve what you might have bought 15 little things to do.
Well, and this week I'm digging a book. For all those of you who are members of the unofficial Young House Stuff as a Podcast book club,
I think we've recommended like the most random assortment of like murder mysteries, nonfiction.
Yes, this is a nonfiction book about homes, actually. It's entitled This Is Where You Belong. The subtitle is The Art and Science of Loving the Place You Live, which combines all of my favorite things.
Art and science.
Science.
Houses.
Living.
Being alive.
It's written by a woman named Melody Warnick. And I should explain that it's not about loving your house. Like, it's not about your specific house or decorating or anything like that. It's about your town or your city and about loving the community that you live in. And the backstory is that the author moved to a new town and she didn't like it. She had moved a lot in her life and she went to a new city for work for her husband and was having trouble feeling at home. So what she did was she went through a bunch of love where you live experiments where she looked into research about how do we become connected to the places we live. And she tried to put those into action so that she could start to feel more at home in her new city. I was attracted to the book because I love these kind of mixes of storytelling, also with like lots of facts and studies and interesting research to them. Like, it's a very nerdy book, but it also tells you a lot of interesting stuff about like why we love the places that we call home. I also was attracted to it because the town that she moved to that she hated was Blacksburg, Virginia, which is where my alma mater's rival school, Virginia Tech, is located. And I love the idea of reading about why someone hated this rival town.
But then, spoiler alert, she taught herself to love it.
Yes, and I do like Blacksburg. I know we have a lot of Hokies who listen, so I won't put it down. But I will say there was a slight satisfaction in that being part of the book. But it was also interesting because we have a couple friends right now that are kind of struggling with this same thing of like feeling at home in their cities that they currently live in. They've had to move and they're just not gelling with the place.
Yeah, we know two couples going through this, so it's common.
Yeah, and it was a really interesting read for that reason, to think about sort of what they're experiencing, because she does say in the book that studies show it takes you like 3 to 5 years or maybe 3 to 6 years to feel completely settled in a new place. Like, some of the things she says, if you are struggling with loving the place that you live, or if you even just want to feel even more in love with your town, she said things like shop local, go out and walk more, get involved in like local projects or politics. And she does these broad scale things as to why those things make us feel connected. And then she also goes through some experiments for herself, like where she tried to start like a community art project, or she at one point actually went around and hung all these directional signs around town that said like, it's only a 10-minute walk to this park, or like a 5-minute walk to this historical place, to try to get people in her town to walk more.
That's so cute.
Yeah, it was a really cool book. And in the end, she did end up loving Blacksburg.
Aw, and you're okay with that.
Yeah, and I guess I'll survive.
Thanks for listening to Young House Love Has a Podcast.
And if you guys enjoyed this episode or maybe even learned a little something from it, please tell another design or DIY enthusiast about it. Or even just a person who has a home and maybe a pair of headphones. We really appreciate your help in spreading the word about our podcast so we can keep making it.
And keep telling us what you do while you listen. Like Rachel C., who was in Jamaica for her 80th, 81st, and 82nd Hanson concerts.
I feel like she's setting a world record at this point.
And don't forget to check out younghouselove.com/podcast for all the bonus links, photos, and info from this episode.
Like that article with more details about the top-rated paint brands.
And my mood board of large decorative objects. Seriously, it is worth it for the fern link alone, you guys.
Later.
Bye.
And spoiler alert. And spoiler alert. And spoiler alert. I can't say that word. And spoiler alert.
And spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. It's a weird word. There's a lot of L's.
You keep saying spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.